everyone's understanding of the changes of the environment we're in is an increasing threat, not a decreasing threat. And so that's why everyone is so concerned about your now proposing a decrease.
Congress questions cuts in the missile system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 22nd of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight.
Now, Mother Nature might throw us more fish. We could be off on our forecast, so there might be more fish coming back. Or the fish that are coming back decide to come in a shorter time period. That will cause problems.
Will there be enough processors on hand to handle Briscoe Bay runs? Those stories and more tonight.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Yukon River floodwaters are beginning to recede in Russian Mission, although the National Weather Service has issued flood warnings in effect through today from Russian Mission to Pilot Station. A significant ice jam is lodged about 5 miles upriver from Pilot Station, and flood watches are in effect until Monday from St. Mary's to Imonik and Alakanuk on the Bering Sea coast. Although waters are dropping in Russian Mission, several homes and roads are still underwater. It's been 5 days since river water swept into the village, and further downriver, villagers are watchful. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
In Russian Mission, several families are still homeless. Matthew Kazivnikov is the housing administrator for the village tribe. He says a housing shortage is already one of the biggest challenges facing Russian Mission. The flood has compounded that. With water levels dropping, the village runway is now visible, but some of it is still underwater and it's unusable. That has left the village without any plane services for a week. Groceries are running low, but Kazivnikov says it's causing other hardships on the village. This week, a Russian Mission man in his 30s passed away in Anchorage.
His boat is waiting for our runway down. It's good enough for his body to come home. So we're all anxiously waiting. And it makes our hearts a little more heavy.
Kazivnikov says the village has been fortunate that no one has fallen ill or suffered a medical emergency during the flood. He says the village is praying that the runway opens up soon.
It's pretty scary when you think about the need for a patient getting, someone getting hurt or sick, and we need a medevac, you know.
Much of the Russian Mission flood was caused by an ice jam downriver in front of Marshall. That jam has released, but it's run into and combined with another thick ice flow to create a 40-mile stretch of running ice. This afternoon, that flow ran in front of Pilot Station. Abraham Kelly is the Pilot Station mayor.
We had a bank-to-bank ice moving pretty rapidly coming down the river, and since then it's been moving. We've had the water come up maybe 3 or 4 feet since the ice started moving.
The village of Marshall is waiting for water levels to drop there so that they can access their airport. Currently, the bridge to the airport is completely submerged, forcing residents and elders to walk several hundred yards after boating across the water impasse. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
No signs so far of a missing solo climber on Denali. Denali National Park Service spokeswoman Maureen McLaughlin says there was no sighting of 41-year-old Gerald Myers during an aerial search earlier today. The 2-hour search by the crew of a fixed-wing airplane found no sign of the Centennial Colorado man. Cloud cover and high winds hampered visibility during the search on Thursday. Myers was last seen Wednesday afternoon as he climbed the ridge approaching Denali's summit. A team traveling about 2 hours behind him did not see any signs of Myers. He had skis with him, but little survival gear. McLaughlin says aerial searches will continue today, weather permitting. The head of the Missile Defense Agency made his case before Congress yesterday for the program's upcoming budget, which will stop construction on new missile silos at Fort Greely. APRN's Libby Casey reports that Lieutenant General Patrick O'Reilly's plans did not go down well with some members of the House Armed Services Subcommittee, but others thought they were right on track.
General O'Reilly defended the Obama administration's new numbers, which would cut more than $500 million from the ground-based missile program and freeze the number of interceptor silos at Fort Greely in Delta Junction. O'Reilly says they'll stop at 26 silos in Alaska and 4 at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. He says the department has already bought all the interceptors it originally committed to, but rather than build new silos for them, the extra missiles will replace older ones and be used for testing and operational spares.
We're going to proceed on with all 44 interceptors. What's been limited to 30 is the deployment of the silos. So there are 30 silos. Now, we have built other silos, and so we have them in storage. So it gives us flexibility for the future.
O'Reilly says the focus of the Missile Defense Agency is shifting to mid-range and short-range missile threats rather than the long-range ones Fort Greely defends against. That didn't sit well with some of the subcommittee's Republicans, who said it seemed arbitrary and wanted to see intelligence to back it up. The panel's top Republican, Congressman Michael Turner of Ohio, criticized the decision to freeze the number of silos in Alaska.
The department appears to be making profound missile defense program and budget decisions prior to the administration's completion of its missile defense policy and strategy review.
Turner asked, what was the information that justified the switch in focus? General O'Reilly said the initial decision to have 44 interceptors was reached years ago with data he's not even seen. Congressman Turner reacted to that with concern.
Is the data on which it was based lost to you? I mean, you say you haven't seen it. Because what we would like to see is what has changed. Everyone's understanding of the changes of the environment we're in is an increasing threat, not a decreasing threat. And so that's why everyone is so concerned about you're now proposing a decrease.
General O'Reilly says he agrees that the threat is increasing, namely from North Korea and Iran, which had an orbital rocket launch this week.
Sir, I believe it's increased significantly. And I base that assumption on the intelligence information. I'm a customer. I don't develop intelligence, but I use it. And the demonstration of the capability of the Iranian ability to put a satellite in orbit, albeit small, shows that they are progressing in that technology.
But still, O'Reilly defended the move to trim the ground-based systems budget, saying that recent decisions about missile defense have been made with strategy in mind rather than technical judgments. Now, more joint chiefs and actual warfighters are weighing in, and the new budget request reflects their influence. O'Reilly says he's concerned that the system be reliable, and that needs more attention in the budget.
During fiscal year 2008 and fiscal year 2009 to date, we experienced 9 significant flight test delays, 4 target failures out of 18 target launches, and 1 interceptor failure in flight. These and other contributing factors have resulted in a $264 million cost growth.
In his written testimony, O'Reilly also said he's concerned with lapses in quality management by the program's contractors and said he hopes to hold them more accountable. Democrats on the subcommittee largely praised the Obama administration's decision to refocus the missile defense system. Congressman Robert Andrews of New Jersey said both missile defense and the national security space programs are justifying their decisions.
I don't think either of you have made a major change in your assessment of the threat that the country faces. I do think you've made a major change in the way we assess the evidence in these programs. Frankly, switching from a faith-based approach to these programs to an evidence-based approach, which we agree with.
The requested budget for missile defense for fiscal year 2010 is $7.8 billion. That's down from earlier estimates of more than $9 billion made during the Bush administration. However, General O'Reilly says there is a review due to be completed by next month on the issue of placing more interceptors at Fort Greely in the future. A decision on that will come later. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
It's day 2 of the annual conference of the Center for Ocean Law and Policy, and people are gathered in Seward for the big event. They're hearing about changes in the Arctic Ocean. Ben Stanton from member station KDLL is in Seward and has this report.
To start the day, David Karen from the Law of the Sea Institute in Berkeley, California, critiqued an academic paper talking about Arctic issues. Karen agrees that fisheries are affected.
She's in part here focusing about, that there's a great deal of uncertainty on what's happening, and how the movement that we've been seeing in other parts of the world, whether that will continue into the Arctic region, how will that occur?
Another presenter talked about polar bears. Nigel Banks from the University of Calgary says regulations in the U.S. and Canada and other agreements have attempted to protect polar bears. Banks says there's only so much that can be done with those agreements. In 1973, the governments of Canada, Denmark, Norway, the USSR, and the United States made the agreement on the conservation of polar bears. Later, Greenland was added. Banks related the agreement to habitat and ecosystem protection. The agreement acknowledges the special responsibilities of Arctic states for Arctic ecosystems.
And that's something that Arctic states are very fond of espousing. I think both nationally, the Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act in Canada, and internationally. A special role, almost the language of trusteeship for this area. It's almost as if, you know, we're not satisfied with our rights under the Law of the Sea Agreement. We want, you know, the world community to recognize that we've got additional rights and responsibilities.
To conclude, Banks says the Arctic is the most vulnerable to climate change.
I'm not sure that I need to answer it. Has international law failed the polar bear? I think the only dispute might be, well, do we blame international law, or do we blame other political processes and lack of political commitment?
Fink says it's not an either-or, but both those contributors, and hopes international law and lawyers consider the responsibilities. Commander James McMahon from the United States Coast Guard explained what they're concerned about dealing with the changes themselves.
We heard of how it is presenting new opportunities and challenges for all of us. Now, the Coast Guard does not know exactly why this is happening, and we do not know how quickly this change will occur. But what we do know is that there is now open water where there used to be ice. And as a result, we have certain statutory obligations and commitments that we have to meet.
This afternoon, David Balton from the U.S. State Department gave a policy perspective on Arctic fishing. Several native Alaskans gave their perspective on the Arctic and development as well. In Seward, I'm Ben Stanton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly. A Kotzebue Immersion School keeps the language alive. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Doyon family of companies, working together to build Alaska's future.
Alaska Congressman Don Young crossed party lines yesterday to be one of only four Republicans who voted for a Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill. The bill would fund the FAA to modernize air traffic control and improve airline safety. Reauthorization has been delayed for 2 years, but top Republicans on the House Transportation Committee said the bill could kill American jobs and start a trade war. Young says he voted for it because the aviation industry is vital to Alaska.
This is very, very important. It is an agency that's in, I think, duress. It has been for a long time, and that's too important for the state of Alaska. We have to have, I think, the best air traffic controllers and best navigation systems in the nation, and it's been sort of in limbo.
Young says overall the bill will help the FAA move forward and improve safety. It called for new contract negotiations between the FAA and air traffic controllers and requires the agency to halt any staff consolidation efforts until a working group can look into the options. Young says that should help controller engineers in Alaska. The congressman says he's been worried engineers in the state would be moved down to Seattle, and he thinks this bill would prevent that.
Why would you want to have someone in Seattle engineering an airport in Alaska? That, to me, is just wrong. We got about 40 engineers in Alaska, you know, that know the airports, been in the area, know the weather conditions, know the terrain.
Are other Alaska-specific angles. It would continue three-dimensional mapping in the state and would provide for a land exchange between Merrill Field and the municipality of Anchorage to widen the Glenn Highway and reduce congestion. The Inupiaq Immersion School in Kotzebue is getting ready to expand. The tiny one-room school currently teaches preschool, kindergarten, and first grade, but next year, teachers and students will move to a two-room building and accept second graders for the first time. It's an important step for an institution that's playing a crucial role in keeping the endangered language alive. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Polly Schaefer remembers the day 10 years ago when the Gaitchote School first opened its doors.
It was scary.
There was no artwork on the walls and only a ragtag mix of hand-me-down furniture to fill the space. The Gaitchote had just a few committed teachers, like Schaefer, and a classroom of eager students. But Schaefer says that first day was gratifying.
It took us a while to really push for it. And then once we got it opened, it was... What took us so long?
These days, the one-room school is bright and colorful, filled with pint-sized tables and chairs. Big posters with the Inupiaq alphabet decorate the walls. 20 kids sit cross-legged in front of a whiteboard, leaning in as teacher trainee Wanda Baltazar goes over the morning lesson. In the last decade, the private school has become an essential part of the community. Elders like Schaefer, who grew up speaking the language, recognized it was dying. But Schaefer says it was the young parents who pushed hardest for the school. Schaefer says knowing the language is a critical part of what it means to be Inupiaq.
It's our self-identity. It's who we are. Once you know who we are, the language, the culture, no matter where you go, when you leave, you'll always be grounded. I think that's missing in some schools. Not knowing who they are, they're just kind of lost.
Teacher Wanda Baltazar understands exactly what Schaefer means when she talks about kids being lost. Baltazar's mother was from Kotzebue, but she grew up in California, not knowing her Inupiaq family. She was 23 when she moved to Kotzebue.
And I had only said I was going to be up here for a year, but after being up here, I realized that this is what I had been missing. The culture and the people is what I needed. I needed that. I was lacking that in my self-identity. And when I began to listen to it and started to eat the food and do the cultural activities and join again with my people here, my mother's family, I realized that that is what I needed, and that made me feel better. As an individual, it made me stronger.
When Baltazar started having her own children, she was determined they would learn Inupiaq. Her daughter was one of the first students at Nagaitchode. Now she's 14 years old, getting ready for high school. Baltazar's two younger boys are also graduates of the immersion school.
They're not afraid of anything. My kids are very brave, considering where I was when I was their age. I was very timid, but themselves, they are so secure in their knowledge of who they are and where they come from that they're not afraid to speak with other people or speak Inupiaq to other people or ask people to speak Inupiaq to them.
Besides learning the language, Nagaitchote students are immersed in cultural activities that define life in the region. The teachers sneak state standards into a curriculum filled with hunting, dog mushing, and fishing. Berry picking trips offer the chance to teach basic shapes and colors. And Polly Schaefer says Inupiaq values are also a big part of every lesson plan.
Mostly, kamakshilutin, to be respectful of themselves, to each others, to animal and nature.
Traditional songs are another important teaching tool. The kids sing standing up in a circle. Next year, when the school expands to second grade, 10 more spots will open up. But at 30 students, there will still be a long wait list. Wanda Baltazar hopes eventually kids will continue on through high school and even college. It's a big dream for such a small school, but the name Nagaycho encourages that kind of thinking. It means anything is possible. For APRN, I'm Annie Fite.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Sockeye salmon will be heading into Bristol Bay nets in a few weeks, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is worried that there may not be enough processing capacity there to handle the runs. The agency has released a document highlighting the probability of sockeye harvests in the bay exceeding the processing capacity this season. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
In recent years, the limits placed on the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fisheries have been in part due to a lack of processing capacity during peak days. As a preview of the upcoming season, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game recently released a report projecting the daily catches and processing capacity in the bay this year. It should be noted that the projections have huge variability because they're based on the projected 2009 harvest, which is 23.9 million fish. The projection puts the daily processing capacity in the bay at 1.8 million fish, which under one scenario would be enough to handle the harvest on the busiest day. Another aspect of the analysis is the probability that harvest will exceed the daily processing capacity. It shows a 30 to 50% probability of catches exceeding the daily processing capacity for one day from June 30th to July 8th. This is concerning to Bob Waldrop, the executive director of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. That organization was formed by driftboat fishermen and women as a way to better address market and legislative concerns.
That day will affect the future day's processing capacity as well. And we will get into something like we faced last year, where we had multiple days of limits. But the chances, one in two, of getting to that point, there's a pretty good chance we won't get to that point. So I think that the Fish and Game have made an honest effort to provide some predictive data for the first time ever.
The projected daily catches and processing capacity in Bristol Bay for 2009 is in addition to a processing capacity survey for Bristol Bay that was released in February. The survey included 13 processors who submitted responses indicating that they will be buying salmon this season. The total processing capacity for the season based on the survey is 30.7 million sockeye salmon, which is 6.8 million fish above the forecasted harvest of 23.9 million. Jeff Regnard is the ADF&G Division of Commercial Fisheries Regional Supervisor. He says the available data indicates that processors should be able to handle the sockeye run this year.
With the size of the forecast we have and the processing capacity that they told us they're going to bring, I would say Mother Nature would have to throw us a bit of a curveball for us to run into problems. We don't typically have problems with this kind of capacity with a 23 million run. Now, Mother Nature might throw us more fish. You know, we could be off on our forecast, so there might be more fish coming back, or the fish that are coming back decide to come in a shorter time period. That will cause problems.
In recent months, quite a bit of research and work has been done to deal with the issues of foregone harvest and processing capacity. For instance, the Bristol Bay Native Association has created a special committee that includes representatives from the Native Association, the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, the Governor's Office, Seafood Processors, and the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. The committee has yet to put together formal recommendations for state fishery managers and processors. However, the committee has several project and policy priorities. As an example, the committee believes that if limits are put in place this year, they should be defined and tracked on a daily or tide basis. Additionally, the committee wants management strategies modified in season to accommodate processing capacity and economics. The CEO of the Bristol Bay Native Association is Ralph Anderson. He says limits and suspensions run counter to the work ethic at the heart of the commercial fishing industry.
The people in our region are hard workers. We all are. I mean, we grew up around the fishing industry. I mean, commercial fishing was our, and it still is, the backbone of our economy. We all grew up relying upon the hard work that it takes for fishing. I mean, we are a very proud people that we're able to work and we're able to provide for our families. I mean, it is disappointing that, you know, fishermen are being put on limits, and it's, you know, it's sort of demoralizing, you know, to the extent that they're not able to really practice the kinds of things that they were raised doing.
Commercial fishing in Bristol Bay is a business that employs thousands of people, both directly and indirectly. The industry is generally considered the backbone of the Bristol Bay economy. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And for those of you following the wet dog expedition, the jet skiers are delaying their departure from Anchor Point. After working until the early morning hours separating water from their gas and replacing fouled fuel injectors, the five jet skiers are ready to go back into the water. But according to team leader John Lang, they feel the need for a shakedown cruise before hitting the open ocean. Weather is also a factor for the team, and an approaching low is giving them pause because the marine weather forecast for the Barren Islands is calling for a gale warning tonight and tomorrow and northeast winds to 35 knots and seas building to 12 feet. Lang said it looks like the earliest they can leave Anchor Point is Sunday morning. They plan on crossing to Port Graham at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula before heading for Kodiak. Their ultimate destination is Iliamna after they round the Alaska Peninsula. Police in Skagway are trying to reduce the number of impaired peddlers. Chief Ray Leggett says drunks riding around town on bicycles are a problem for emergency responders. Leggett says police also have to deal with bike thefts on a daily basis. He asked the Skagway Assembly to pass a motion that would allow police to fine impaired bikers $300. That was voted down, but police and politicians say they're now exploring other ways to deal with the problem. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Seward, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Annie Fite in Kotzebue, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Helen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell HKM, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowellhkm.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.